supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez is back on the campaign trail. He kicked off his re-election bid today with stops in North and South Jersey. But the New Jersey Democrat is already having to deal with the fallout from his corruption trial last year. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
A is for my attitude, working through the patience. Money comes and goes, so the M is for motivation. Gotta stay consistent.
Menendez was bouncy and upbeat as he addressed local officials and supporters at a South Jersey community college. Introduced by his son, Rob, Menendez talked about his immigrant parents and working on behalf of the voiceless in the Senate. The Democrat also suggested to his supporters that they needed to elect somebody who would stand up to Republican President Donald Trump.
I know that candidates always say that this election is the most important ever, but think about the events of the past year. The chaos, the division, the dysfunction.
What Menendez did not mention was his recent corruption trial. Last fall, Menendez and his co-defendant, Florida eye doctor Salomon Melgen, were brought up on corruption and bribery charges in federal court. Prosecutors said Menendez did Melgen government favors in exchange for lavish gifts and trips, including free flights on the doctor's private jet. The judge eventually threw the case out after the jury failed to reach a verdict, and the Justice Department says it will not retry the case. Still, that hasn't stopped the Democrats' leading Republican rival from dredging the legal saga back up.
Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey has been indicted.
This ad from former pharmaceutical executive Bob Hugin says even though Menendez was never found guilty of a crime, he still disgraced the Garden State.
Charged him. Menendez insists he was just helping a friend.
That's not friendship. That's corruption.
Hugin says Menendez isn't good enough for New Jersey, but the Republican political newcomer has faced criticism of his own. While Hugin was running the pharmaceutical company Celgene, the firm hiked the price of its popular cancer drug several times. Although Menendez didn't mention Hugin by name, he seemed to take a shot at his likely general election opponent.
When drug companies were hiking costs on cancer patients, I was working to make medicine affordable for families and seniors.
As New Jersey nears its June 5th primary, expect attacks on both sides to pick up. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Tomorrow kicks off the last round of pretrial hearings before Bill Cosby again faces a jury over sexual assault charges next week. Last year, a jury couldn't decide whether to convict or acquit Cosby on the same allegations arising from a 2004 encounter in his Montgomery County home. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that with a new jury, new defense attorneys, and a new era of accountability for sexual assault, the upcoming trial won't just be a rerun of the first.
Cosby faces three counts of aggravated indecent assault for allegedly drugging and molesting Andrea Constand more than a decade ago. Constand, a former basketball player with a skyscraping curly hairdo, testified that Cosby gave her three pills that he indicated were herbal, but were something else. She says that something else made her feel frozen and pass out during his advances. Bobby Dugan was a juror during that first trial. He says the lack of explicit consent during the encounter convinced him Cosby was guilty.
In my opinion, consent is a verbal agreement, and that's the way it should be, and that's the way it's always has been. If there is no verbal agreement, then there is no consent.
Defense attorneys argued Cosby and Constand had a romantic relationship. Dugan says he wanted to convict, but ultimately the jury couldn't reach a unanimous decision. This time, a new jury is going to hear new witnesses. A judge recently ruled to allow testimony from up to five women, in addition to Constand, who say Cosby also drugged and sexually assaulted them. Veteran defense attorney Thomas Bergstrom, who's not affiliated with the case, says that's a gift for the prosecution and a challenge for the defense.
I think you have to change your strategy a little bit when there's only one witness versus whether there's five. If there's one, I think you can still argue effectively that it's consensual. But the more you get, the less consensual it is.
These women have not been identified yet, and their claims aren't the ones on trial. But they are allowed to testify to help a jury decide whether Cosby knew what he was doing. Cosby's new lead defense attorney, Tom Mesereau, who previously defended Michael Jackson against child molestation charges, is bringing in new evidence, too. In court documents, the defense has asked to call a witness they say shows Constand planned to fabricate a claim of sexual assault in order to get a big payout. But perhaps the biggest difference between the trial last June and next week isn't anything inside the courtroom. It's the explosion of allegations of sexual harassment and assault against high-profile men, known as the Me Too movement. Lily Bernard is an actress and artist, and one of the more than 50 women who have accused Cosby of assault.
I think that the Me Too movement is serving to educate people as to why victims remain silent for so long when they see that these big celebrities have been silent for decades.
She'll be holding silent vigils outside the courthouse every night, one of several actions planned to draw attention to survivors of sexual assault during the trial. And what about the man himself? During pretrial hearings earlier this month, Cosby shuffled past reporters on the arm of his assistant, visibly aged since his TV days. But he still has that signature laugh.
Ready for trial, Mr. Cosby?
He seemed unfazed by the legal acrobatics taking place around him to determine, in the eyes of the law, whether he's a sexual predator or an old philanderer. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
Every day, Philadelphia judges are deciding the fate of defendants by trying to strike the right balance between public safety and fairness. Now, District Attorney Larry Krasner is asking his prosecutors to share another factor with judges: the cost of incarceration. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the move has sparked a debate about whether the price tag of punishment belongs in courtrooms.
Krasner came into office promising to shrink the city's prison system. Standing in front of reporters recently in the district attorney's office, Krasner says having judges consider the taxpayer expense of jail is one step toward that goal.
Fiscal responsibility is a justice issue. And it is an urgent justice issue.
In Philadelphia, the average cost of holding someone behind bars annually, about $42,000. And the tab for housing all the city's prisoners for Philadelphia's Department of Corrections, $2.4 billion a year. So if a prosecutor says someone convicted of, say, assault should go to jail for 4 years, that prosecutor has to say, "Judge, it will cost taxpayers more than $160,000 to do this." These kinds of discussions about imprisonment have for decades been reserved for classrooms and think tanks, but Krasner says that needs to change.
A dollar spent on incarceration should be worth it. Otherwise, that dollar may be better spent on addiction treatment, on public education, on policing, and on other types of activity that make us all safer.
Requiring prosecutors in these sentencing hearings to tell judges what it costs to put somebody away is very unusual. In 2010, Missouri made a similar proposal making cost information available to judges, but it wasn't mandatory that it be considered. University of Pennsylvania law and economics professor David Abrams says having prosecutors announce the cost of jail in open court is different and unprecedented. But will it really mean shorter punishments?
I think there are going to be a lot of cases that will not be affected by this, but I think there are going to be marginal cases where the judge is somewhat indifferent between harsher and maybe more expensive sentences and slightly less harsh and maybe vastly less expensive sentences where this will make a difference.
Not everybody in Philadelphia's criminal justice world is embracing this news. Some prosecutors have confided that they're ignoring the guidance completely. And one judge recently said he'd hold an assistant district attorney in contempt of court if the cost issue was raised again. Richard Sachs is not surprised. He spent more than 30 years as a prosecutor in Philadelphia's district attorney's office before retiring last year. Here's his assessment of bringing up the cost of jail to a judge.
The words that come to mind are absurd, irrelevant, ridiculous, nonsense, and horrific.
Sachs calls Krasner's announcement a public relations stunt and says it's insulting to crime victims.
It should have no bearing on whether society or community or people who are at risk of being victimized should be protected from a human being, an individual.
And some families of crime victims do agree, like Celestine Shorts of North Philadelphia. Her brother, Christopher, was murdered last year. She says she doesn't want to see money be a factor in the perpetrator's punishment.
What happened to the structure of the judicial system and the rights of the families that are affected by it? Why are we here every day? To listen to you throw our family in a corner and say you really don't exist. This situation doesn't matter to you.
DA Krasner says input from victims and families will be considered. That's not going anywhere. The money factor is just an additional consideration. And he says research shows shorter sentences do not actually cause increases in crime. Longtime defense lawyer Michael Diamonstein says prosecutors in recommending punishment to a judge have a ton of power over defendants' life and liberty. The change isn't going to please everyone, but Diamonstein says it's about time the criminal justice system tries something new.
Nothing ventured, nothing gained, and the worst thing that happens is it makes no difference, but it may make a judge or two stop and think about what the actual cost is to sentencing someone.
With the help of money from the MacArthur Foundation, city officials have been working the past few years to cut the number of people behind bars by one-third. But individual decisions by a judge are much harder to influence. Krasner hopes to give them a nudge. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Across the country, women are underrepresented in computer science and other technology industries. A national grassroots movement aims to reverse that disparity, one school at a time, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
The tiny toy robots look a little like the ghosts from the old Pac-Man arcade game, but these little devices are called Ozobots, and they're helping students from Middletown learn the basics of computer programming.
They roll around, and you need to draw like a track with them with multiple colors. The base color is black, and then you can add little dots in multiple colors. In different patterns, they recognize different codes, and they do what that movement tells them to do.
Seventh grader Yashu Panaganti and her classmates love playing and learning with Ozobots. They are in the 52-member strong Girls Who Code Club at Alfred G. Waters Middle School.
Some of them, if you do it forwards, it does one thing, but if you read it backwards, it does another thing.
Girls Who Code has programs in all 50 states, serving thousands of girls. Delaware has 11 clubs. The overarching goal is to reduce the gender gap in computer science. Fewer than 1 in 3 college graduates with degrees in computer science or information sciences are women. And the U.S. Department of Commerce report shows the number of women working in science, technology, engineering, and math jobs has actually gotten worse in the past 2 decades.
Things should never be just for boys or just for girls. I feel like if you want to do something, you should do it. So girls in getting into coding is a great thing because it basically breaks the barriers of genders.
Caitlin Scott, the librarian at Waters, embraced the chance to start a club at school last year.
We realize that it's important for girls to start to realize that this is a career path that they could go into and hopefully meet with great success.
The kids meet weekly after school for 2 hours. Scott delivers a brief lecture on a tech topic or a woman in the industry. Then the kids split into groups. Some work with the Ozobots, others design websites, some create digital music. A handful work on robotics projects, such as a programmable smart car. For 7th grader Samantha Sparks, participating in the coding club will lay the groundwork for a career in robotics or software engineering.
I love playing video games, and I think it would be cool to create one day. I want to make an RPG fantasy kind of game, kind of like World of Warcraft or Final Fantasy.
Scott says the girls bring a different mindset to coding and technology assignments.
Some of the girls in our club are very chatty. They like to talk their whole way through. Should we put the screw here? Should we put the screw there? Well, what if I hold this wire and you hold that wire and then you're the soldering? But the car they end up building is just as good and sometimes even better.
The bottom line, though, and perhaps the best gauge of the club's impact, is that many of the Girls Who Code members at Waters are now pondering careers in tech. They even told us so.
Photographer or computer science.
An engineer.
Software engineer.
A STEM engineer.
An aerospace engineer.
A forensic scientist.
Software engineer.
Aerospace engineer.
Chemical engineer.
Computer scientist.
Software engineer.
President of the United States of America.
From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
With the Philly season getting underway tomorrow afternoon, let's first pause for perspective, noting the extent to which Philadelphia is front and center when recalling the legacy of Negro League baseball and one of the game's star catchers. It's a topic covered by esteemed baseball historian and author Rich Westcott, whose new book is entitled Biz Mackey, A Giant Behind the Plate, the story of the Negro League star and Hall of Fame catcher. Rich, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Good to be here, Dave.
We'll take up Biz Mackey, but first, hearken back to Negro League baseball. It's an era that essentially ended with integration back in 1947. What was its heyday?
You can look at Negro League baseball, and not professionally, but as teams, playing right after the Civil War. And there were some well-known teams in the Philadelphia area who played back then. And then professionally, teams began in the early 1900s. And when you get down to it, Philadelphia has a great Negro League history, which lasted for about 50 years in this city up until the early 50s. And Biz Mackey was a part of it. He played here for 9 years and played on two championship teams. So he was a part of this great history that, unfortunately, a lot of people don't know about.
When we consider Philadelphia as a hotbed for Negro League baseball, it's the general area. We can factor in parks in Ambler and Ardmore and Norristown and Wilmington, Delaware. Let's talk about the Hilldale Daisies out of Derby.
Well, the Hilldale Daisies had a great history, and they were originally formed in 1910. It was basically an organization for young boys. And it was a club in which they played sports, particularly baseball. But as time went on, more and more older boys joined the club, and eventually they played such good baseball that in 1917, Hilldale became a rather well-established and well-known local baseball team. And shortly thereafter, Biz Mackey came along and joined the team, and eventually, they won the Negro League championship in 1925.
So when the Daisies folded in 1932, there to take up the mantle, the Philadelphia Stars, who played in West Philadelphia at Parkside Park.
Right. The Stars were formed in 1933, and then 1 year later, they won the championship. And Mackey was on that team, too. The Stars actually had a much longer history. They played until the early 50s. Long after African-American players have been accepted in Major League Baseball.
Baseball is numbers, and you have Biz Mackey's statistics, but tell us about him as a player.
He wasn't a power hitter, but he could hit. He was a switch hitter. But he was also an outstanding defensive catcher who could throw a runner out at second base from his knees. Players were reluctant to bunt because he'd throw you out for sure. And in addition to that, he knew how to handle pitchers. He was a team leader. He had all these things going for him. And, you know, when you say analytics notwithstanding, when you say how good a player is, you know, he's got to hit, run, catch, and throw, and think. And Mackey did all of those. That's why he's generally regarded as the greatest all-around catcher.
We haven't even begun to talk about Biz Mackey as a post-player manager, where he also enjoyed its success.
Well, he did. He managed the Newark Eagles and the Baltimore Elite Giants. And with Newark, he won a Negro League championship in 1946. But along the way, he had a lot of players who made the major leagues. Monty Irvin, Larry Doby, Don Newcomb, they all played for Mackey as a manager.
Rich, I believe this is your 26th book, many of them about baseball, which is a wonderful sport in part because it's so predicated on statistics. Having said that, was it a particular challenge for you to embark on this book, given the dearth of organized statistics around the Negro League seasons and players?
Absolutely. I would have to say, of all my books, it was probably the hardest to do for that very reason. There's very little information about Negro League baseball or games. The white papers barely even mention Negro League baseball. And even the African-American papers didn't write a whole lot about Negro League baseball. And even though they did cover games in a lot of cases, they don't have archives. and a lot of them are out of business. So you couldn't go there to look up information. And fortunately, the Hall of Fame has some stuff. They have pretty good information on Negro League baseball.
It's a wonderful account of him and the Negro League. Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Rich Westcott, esteemed baseball historian and author. His new book is entitled Biz Mackey, A Giant Behind the Plate, the story of the Negro League star and Hall of Fame catcher. Finally this evening, yeah, it's only Wednesday, but many of us already wish it was the weekend. Well, if you can hold out another couple of days, you can pay some of your hard-earned money to smash stuff. Thunderbird Salvage is holding its first Rage Cage this Friday night, and for as little as $20, you can don a hard hat and get some catharsis by taking a bat or crowbar to old printers, TVs, dinnerware, and most any other junk. Research shows the idea makes good business sense. A recent Philadelphia Magazine survey shows that more than 96% of respondents would pay to smash things. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.